Welcome to the first podcast of the International Institute of Social Studies, part of Erasmus University Rotterdam. The debate you are about to listen to was recorded on the 8th of October 2020 on the subject of three crises in the world: COVID-19, climate change, and Black Lives Matter. It was hosted by ISS Rector Professor Inge Hutter and journalist Marcia Lauter. Enjoy.
To be very ambitious in this hour because we've got three, I must say, big topics. We want to discuss the three of them with our three guests who we'll introduce right away. But let me first give you an idea of our program because we start each discussion with a short kickoff by one of the three speakers. Next, we will discuss the topic with the three of them. Let me introduce our guests. We have here in person, and I'm very happy that you're here, Aminata Cairo. She's a former lecturer of inclusive education at The Hague University of Applied Sciences, and she's a frequent guest here at ISS. Recently, she gave an impressive speech at a demonstration against racism in Amsterdam. Welcome, Aminata.
Thank you.
Next to her is Murat Arcel. He's professor of political economy of sustainable development at ISS. Welcome. And Wendy Harcourt, professor of gender diversity and sustainable development, also here at ISS. Welcome. Yes, our first discussion topic is COVID-19 and its consequences for care. And we want to start with Wendy Harcourt and her take on the crisis.
Hi, my name is Wendy Harcourt and I'm a professor here at the International Institute of Social Studies. I'm going to raise the issue of how can we live through these depressing times? What are the ways we can think about the world anew? And for me, instead of getting lost into depression, I'm really thinking about how can I rethink care. So for me, this is the message for us today in terms of how can we live with COVID, how can we move beyond these strange times and think about regeneration and hope. For me, care is now the what was once invisible, now visible thing that we have to be really dealing with. How can we rethink our idea of who we care for, in, not only in terms of our intimate relations, but also in terms of the biopolitics of the state. The issue of who cares for whom is really deeply divided, as we can see, by gender, race, and age. Even in the richest country in the world, the US, those divisions run deep. And the people who have died of COVID, it's not just because of their own vulnerabilities, because the state did not care. In other parts of the world, where we know they're poor, the care of the community, the care of the state has led to far less deaths. These are lessons we have to learn from. Indeed, I think the biggest lesson is we realize that focusing on growth only and not looking at care for communities really shows the failure of capitalism. We have to understand how to break these deep social and economic ruptures in our lives. And I think go beyond the idea that after COVID, it's business as usual. So for me, how to move towards collaborative well-being is to put care at the center. Reproductive work is essential. Indeed, we talked about right at the beginning, if you remember, the essential workers, the health workers. But it's not only the health workers, it's all of us, how we care for our communities, our environments, and the ways in which we can be responsible for each other. In this way, the virus has brought out a very different understanding of connectivity, about the ways in which we can live together. And I think these are the lessons that we have to learn as we put care at the center of our economics and at our social lives. For me, these are the types of regenerative, hopeful things which I hope we can move into in a new way of thinking and living together. The fact that we have the government now telling us how to be safe, the fact that we now have to wash our hands, we have to wear masks, all of these remind us that we are vulnerable, but at the same time, it's by recognizing our vulnerability to the virus, we can also change the ways in which we relate to each other through relations of care. So I think this is the way to find ways to regenerate, to build on these relations of care, to nurture new forms of communities, and to place care at the center of our economics. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. You said the virus brought a different understanding of connectivity. What was a truly new insight for communities?
I think for me that
is partly, is can be answered in two ways. One is the digital connectivity. I think we really have learned to live in what I call Zoom land. And it's something that has got its advantages, but has also got huge disadvantages. We're no longer connected together, so there's an irony there. But at the same time, I think we also recognized how we are connected together in terms of our communities, literally in our local communities. I think for many of us, neighbors became very important. People who were looking after us, particularly at the beginning, where we realized that we needed to have help just to even figure out the world that we suddenly found ourselves in. So for me, that's what I meant by care in terms of communities. And connectivity, for me, is something that the virus has shown. It can be visible and invisible.
Well, right, what Wendy is saying about... we realized that we were very dependent on our neighbors, so very nearby relations. Does that have any broader societal or political implications?
I mean, of course it does. I think the connections have always been there. I mean, as Wendy said, they were invisible, and some of those have been made visible. But I think we also have to pay attention to which ones are made visible. I don't think all of them have been made visible equally. I think one of the key lessons of COVID and many other crises is the unequal ways in which they manifest themselves. Like the Zoom land, we live in it and our audience does. But then there's still probably more than half of the world has no access to it. Mm-hmm. So we have to ask who's being made visible and who's being made even more invisible.
And also thinking about care also, but who is deserving, right? And so I'm also thinking...
What do you mean by who is deserving?
Even, you know, like in the Netherlands, you know, there's a system in place that, you know, some of us who have jobs who are in the arts, for instance, like that, you know, you can get funds from the state, even though it's hard, but there's some funds available. But who has access and who's deserving? And in some countries... you have to go to work, whether you want to or not, or you don't eat if you don't leave the house, you know. So do we care enough? You know, so there are people who are going hungry, but there's food available. You know, are we going to hand it out for free? You know, so to me, when I think about care, I think about it. Do we care enough to disrupt some of our systems to make sure that everybody's taken care of, you know?
I think, and that's really a good point, Aminata. That's what I was referring to when I said the biopolitics of the state.
Yeah.
Because what I see is there are very different responses by the state.
Yeah.
And you pointed to the Netherlands, where they handed out, I think, 4,000 euros for entrepreneurs. In Italy, they handed out 400 just in terms of money. But then I also heard of communities in Ethiopia who didn't get those handouts, but were already organized themselves to be able to support in terms of food and care.
Yeah.
So I totally agree. The context is extremely important.
Yeah.
And it's not just global south, global north. It's actually different cultures, how they've been coping with that connectivity.
So you make an international comparison. Did you also see a discrimination in how was being taken care of different groups within, for example, the Dutch society?
Well, I'm not going to be able to answer that because I was in lockdown. Oh, I think maybe Aminata can do that. I was in Italy. So maybe, Aminata, you could share.
What was interesting to me is that when you look at the RIVM, when you look at the restrictions or the messages that are being sent out, they still talk about the Dutch as if it's a homogenous population. And so they don't make distinctions between some populations who are more vulnerable than others.
And which are more vulnerable?
Like, for instance, those who have jobs in the service in industry, you know? And so what you see is mostly people of color who are the caretakers in the nursing homes. And, you know, the people who have those jobs, you know, look like me, you know? So and none of that is addressed. So it's easy, oh, you should stay home. Well, but who are the caretakers of those who are sick? Who are those who work, you know, who provide, who take care of the food? And so they have to go with public transportation. They have to go out. They have to go and mix. And then it's like, well, you know, it's those people who are the ones who are getting sick. And so none of that is being taken into consideration from the RIVM when they talk about the care that's being provided or, you know, well, these people are going to need different kind of care or need different kind of attention than others because of the jobs that they have, because of where they live, because of the access that they have or don't have.
And that, there we're talking very much about the Netherlands, but I think that also applies to the US, where you can see huge groups of people that weren't even weren't even able to get tested or get into right. hospitals, and who were the people who yeah. were dying. But I also, if I could just say, what I see COVID making very visible is also the issue of age, because that was one thing that I think perhaps that is to do with my own age, but there was a sense in which age became very visible.
Yeah.
To be vulnerable was suddenly to be over 65 in ways that I think, at least for the I'm talking here about Europe, perhaps,
yeah.
that wasn't there. And I think that made a big shift. And that's going to make a big shift, I think, in policy in the future in terms of how we look after the aged.
Murat, right. how do you look at this?
I think the question of age in some of the European discussions, there was almost a sense of some people expendable. I mean, an yeah. extension of the question of care is some people are not deserving of that much care. I mean, I've read sort of discussions of how much does it cost to keep an elderly person in the hospital, mm. and maybe it's not worth it. Mm. That type of logic is yeah. not universal. It's being universalized, right. but it was very clear and normalized in Europe, in parts of Europe, whereas in other places, the suggestion that an old person does not deserve care and should be abandoned to the virus would have been unspeakable.
Benny, I have a question. If you plea for more care in economics and care in for each other in social life, is it also not important who is caring? Do you think that there are going to be changes? Who is caring? The gender dimension especially, I mean.
Yeah, no, I think definitely there's a huge gender dimension, because one of the things you realize is that there's been for many years people talking about social reproduction, and the issue of care is obviously central to that. And women have tended are the ones who do that work. So in that sense, it did emerge in important ways, but also the unpaid work of women, but also the very poorly paid work of health workers and of service providers, as Aminata yeah. was saying. Hmm. I think those are the things which have emerged, which are gendered, but they're also racialized. I totally agree. And of course, there's class. So in that sense, we've seen the levels of inequalities. And what you hope is, I think it's been talked about for me, it's been theorized, talked about, but now you hope that people realize you have to make change. So that, to me, is the hope that we have there.
Yeah, so you see these. You say these inequalities were made visible by the virus. You say this ought to lead to change. Do you feel that after 6, 7, 8 months of COVID, that things are changing? Do you see, like, the beginning of a change?
I see people who are resisting in a positive way. Maybe you're going to talk about that with Black Lives Matter, if I anticipate that. But I do see, for example, young people with the Extinction Rebellion and others coming. I mean, there are many, but coming out on the streets, I'm thinking here in the Netherlands. And I think that I see a huge resurgence of people thinking they have to take politics into their own hands. So for me, that's a positive sign, the sense of agency that people have to mm-hmm. resist. This is the biopolitics of the state as well. I'm looking at Murat here. He might feel that that's too positive, but I have to live with that. I have to have that hope. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you would despair. That's what
I mean.
I want to add something, even when it comes to the age, because you know, one argument I have heard when it comes to care and age, you know, the forced isolation and the forced separation, you know, how damaging that has been.
Mm-hmm.
And then also when it comes to the very young, well, they don't get sick that much anyway. And now we're seeing children are getting sick, you know, and we do.
And they do pass it on.
Yes. Yeah. And they do pass it on. And it's so it was like, well, you know, they're fine. Even though we know, you know, we didn't really know. We just knew like you don't see the symptoms or they won't get as sick, you know, but children get sick. They have died. And now we're seeing schools are closing. And so how we care for our children and to take that more seriously as well is one of the things that I see.
Yeah. And Murat, to come back to you, Wendy just mentioned that she feels that this is like an era in which political change is becoming a bit manifest. She also said, I hope for a breakdown of capitalist logic. Do you see any signs of that?
There's some sort of green shoots of that. I wonder if they will grow strong enough. I'm not known for my optimism. So I think, but there are signs of sort of like.
And what are the green shots?
I mean, more young people are in the streets. Extinction Rebellion, again, is an excellent example. Black Lives Matter. I mean, these are different manifestations of a systemic crisis. And I think we're seeing people respond in new ways and more aggressive ways. And I think those are encouraging.
But if you look at, you know, how big they are and the impact they have, like Extinction Rebellion, they have little impact. If you compare it to in the Netherlands, farmers that go out with their trucks. And they do have political impacts, with laws being put off the table and Extinction Rebellion. They're arrested and that's it.
There is a risk that certain groups will secure what they need. The farmers will get the concessions and then they'll go home and will return to a new normal. If a vaccine comes in 6 months and life returns to more or less what it was last year, it is possible that Europe moves on and forgets about global inequality, its role in climate change, and say, well, that was a difficult episode, but we've survived, and we continue as business as usual. There is a major risk of going back to existing structures.
Yeah, because there seems to be like a huge contradiction in what the virus does, because people in the beginning said this is a very democratic threat because it's a threat equal to everybody, whether you're poor or rich. But if you look at how it worked out in society, we've already looked at some inequalities of age, of the lower paid care workers who were exposed. Will there be a change on how we deal with inequality, or will it be as Murat says, once there's a vaccine, we will just forget about it and get back to normal as soon as we can, Wendy?
Well, I think for me, that's what I'm saying. I want to really believe that young people who've lived through this have seen that overnight things could change, right? I mean, suddenly people had to stay in home and they did. So I hope they see that those are the things that change can happen. You can wake up the next day and shops are closed, can't go to school, university. So it's possible to make change, right? So for me, that's where I look at hope in terms of Extinction Rebellion. I don't agree that they get arrested and that's it. They're there. They keep going. They're not only here in the Netherlands, they're across. Mm-hmm. Let's see what that brings. And I think we're in the middle of this crisis. We have not come out of it. If there's a vaccine in 6 months, okay. But I think we actually are having to learn to think about what we value. And I think that's where I'm saying care. Care also for the environment. I know that's your concern too, Murad. But I think these are the things that we are learning to really live with in ways which have to change the way we're doing, especially young people, because they've seen those changes are possible.
And Aminata, do you see a change in equality or inequality with respect to these care workers, many coloured peoples living in verpleeghuizen, hospitals?
Do I see a change?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it also goes back to the politics. I mean, now there's a level of awareness, I'm hoping. People are starting to speak up about these things when it comes to, you know, the appreciation of the nursing and the care staff. It is more on the radar. You know, it's there. It's more on the radar. So I'm with you as far as being hopeful. There's a certain level of awareness now that some people are not going to let go.
Okay. We're moving on. It was mentioned already a little bit with climate change, our second topic. And we will start with a short video of Murat Arsel.
My name is Murat Arsel. I'm a professor of political economy of sustainable development. And I want to speak a little bit about COVID-19 and climate change. COVID-19 is, of course, all about uncertainty. And that makes it difficult to say anything too authoritative on it because it keeps changing. But the fact that it's so uncertain is also what makes it so interesting. The uncertainty of COVID and how it develops didn't stop governments and societies from making some dramatic changes like closing airports, closing down restaurants and pubs, and limiting the freedom of movement of people around the world. These changes were made because it was thought that there is a silver bullet solution to it, like a vaccine that's supposed to come any day now. In the case of climate change, of course, uncertainty has been used the other way. That for a long time, there was uncertainty if it was happening and why it was happening, was used by governments as an excuse not to act. And I think that difference is instructive in this case, because in climate change, there actually is no silver bullet solution. There is no vaccine to climate change, except for dramatic changes like the ones we made for COVID. But in the case of climate change, these changes will have to be long-term, structural, and essentially all across social life. And I think it is that that is stopping both society and governments from pushing for major changes. Nevertheless, the European Union recently announced a European Green Deal, where we're supposed to move towards a green economy based on the idea of circularity. These types of changes, I think, will not go far enough to bring about the type of dramatic changes that we have seen in COVID-19 that will force us to change the way we produce, the way we distribute, and the way we consume and the way we live. I think to be able to deal with COVID and climate change in the long term, we will have to rethink the entire foundations of society and rethink how these changes actually affect different groups in society. We have to pay attention to inequality and how the changes not only don't make these inequalities worse, but in fact go a certain distance in making them better.
Thank you, Murat. Quite some interesting points in 2 minutes. You say there's no silver bullet if it comes to climate change. Uncertainty has always been used as an excuse not to act by governments. And what I think is very interesting is you say our knowledge of climate change is incomparably much better than what we know of this coronavirus, and yet hardly any action is taken to prevent a catastrophe.
The knowledge of climate change has indeed come to a point where you have to be extremely cynical to deny the existence or the seriousness of climate change. Some people are cynical enough to do that, but we shouldn't take them seriously as objects of scientific debate. There's a political point behind denying it. So if it's so obvious, I think the reason why we are not moving forward with the changes that are necessary is because the changes will be painful. We cannot simply rearrange life but continue to consume the way in which we do it, the degree to which we do it. I think there will have to be major redistribution of resources, redistribution of care, redistribution of wealth. And that type of redistribution will not be possible easily or painlessly.
No, you say it will be painful, it will be costly, you mean probably. But I wonder why... Is it impossible to make clear that the costs of doing nothing are so much bigger than the costs of taking action right now?
Because I think the problem is distant and far away, unlike COVID that just suddenly, literally fell from the sky.
No dead bodies.
No dead bodies in the street here. There are dead bodies in the street in other places, but there are no dead bodies in Europe or North America. To the extent that it happened with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, it was not the bodies that got the right attention. So we're not feeling it the way we felt COVID yet. We will. But by then, it will probably be too late.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with you, but I think the real issue is painful for who, right? Because I think the problem is there are a lot of people who are suffering from climate change, as you pointed out, in many, many ways. So I think it's the people who are in power, who are making decisions, who are still thinking maybe until COVID hit, that they could just continue. So I think there is now a connection, right? People are beginning to see that we're going to have to change, even at the richest level. But there are many people at where it's already painful. And I don't know, Murad, for me, it's how do we get the people in political power to change? How do you have some sense of that?
It's not simply the people in political power, if you mean institutional political power. I think we're implicated in this. The tomatoes that we consume from the supermarket down the road are grown in greenhouses burning natural gases. The holidays we take in southern Europe are burnt with oil coming out of the North Sea. We're not demanding these solutions from institutional power because it will be too costly on us. We're complicit in this.
I have a question, because I think it's interesting that the sense of urgency seems to be felt again by the younger generation. You know, as the young people, I don't know if you see it that way, but it's, you know, when you look at the protests, the girl from Sweden, Finland.
Mm-hmm. Greta,
yeah. Yeah, Greta, you know, I mean, and there were others like her, I know, Native American, you know, from all over globally. It's a lot of these young people, these children in some cases, who are, you know, who do feel the urgency, or they say, you know, this world that I'm living in or what's going to be left of it, that they are raising these issues. I wonder how you think about that.
They are very much visible in the way we're responding to it, but I don't think it's only young generations. I think older generations are also seeing this in different ways, in farmer suicides in India. Yeah. You know, that's one aspect of, you know, climate change making agriculture difficult within the context of capitalist injustices.
Yeah.
But their responses are less hopeful or less optimistic. Yeah. And I think there's a certain degree of everyone latching onto young energy, thinking this is the way out. But I think the response is not simply within a certain age group.
Right. I want to come in because I think you're bringing it down to the individual, because I agree there is a sense in which we feel much better if we think we're doing something because we don't buy a particular form of tomato at Albert Heijn or whatever, or we're, you know, recycling. But the big problem really is the people in power, the fossil fuel industries. And though that's where young people and others get out and demonstrate. But I think we have to be careful. I think you, of anybody I know, would see it as institutional, that we really need to deal with that sort of power. I feel we're implicit, we're complicit, but still the enemy is not the individual who doesn't recycle, right?
No, I totally agree. Yeah. But I think the reason why people still vote for this way of living, I mean, the governments in power are legitimate in the sense that electoral democracies in Europe are more or less functional, but they still keep voting for governments that promise more extraction, more growth, more of holidays in Spain, more of tomatoes in Albert Heijn, and for cheaper.
And how do you explain for that, Morant?
I go back to my point. It would be too painful. The reason why there isn't a structural demand for the government to change, there isn't a movement.
But painful for whom?
Painful for us all. You, I, Wendy,
Aminata.
Yeah,
we like to be comfortable.
The lifestyle we built here is too difficult to give up. And
it's built on extraction.
It's built on injustice, inequality, and unsustainability. We know this. We feel this. But putting that into practice is how do you deal with, I mean, we have a building that is here. Students come and study here from all around the world. How do we give this up? And what do we replace it with? It's not people shouldn't fly so much, but our students should still come. This is a learning environment where we should have a mixture of people and cultures. So how do we keep the good things and let go of the bad things? And is that even possible? I think that's the question. And I think so far we haven't found a way that makes it possible to transition to an alternative.
And you make a start with that. Think about what can we do in ISS to really contribute. You can do it by doing research, by publishing about it, because every time this discussion, I feel like, then what can we do? Because it has to start also with people. But what can we do? Because it's too easy to say, no, but the students have to come and we have to travel. But somewhere it has to start.
The clearest, easiest, most effective way for people like us to help is to be allies of people who are fighting for change in even harder conditions. The type of work ISS does with indigenous people, with marginalized people around the world, where we go and help them when they need it, the way they need it, and to support them politically, institutionally, in terms of knowledge production, in terms of resources. I think it's to help those who have it even harder than us. And at the same time, try to learn from their examples and trying to learn from their demands and bring those back to where we are.
And how do we do it? Through research, education, what?
Research, education, teaching, consciousness raising, but sometimes just going out in the streets, sometimes writing, sometimes speaking, and sometimes not acting, sometimes not participating, not taking money from sources that are suspicious.
But what about close to home? Because you have this institution, because I'm learning so much just sitting here next to you. What about the people that live in this neighborhood who are living the lifestyle and this knowledge is here? So, to go to those other places, but what, and again, as a non-member of ISS, so what can ISS mean to help inform the people here? you know, who live the lifestyle every day, because they're going to say, yeah, sure, please go over there and educate those folks. Yeah. And so that I don't have to change anything about what I do here, so that I don't have to, you know, petition my government to do it differently. So what can I, is
well,
that
I think, I think you know the answer to that, because you're working with communities here yeah. in The Hague. And I think ISS is doing a lot more work like that. So you're totally right. It's not about going out to help others. It's actually about engaging with what's going on here, yeah. I particularly around climate change, particularly given the vulnerability of the Dutch, actually, to climate, yeah. given the way it's built and given it's in, yeah, we don't need to say more. But I think the thing is, for me, there are many examples around the world of communities that are doing other things. Okay. And to me, that's the knowledge that we need to build from as well.
Okay. Well, Red, you wrote a piece on an ISS blog. It's called Bliss. There's some beautiful pieces there. So, and you say, when threat and uncertainty both are high, authoritarian rule comes in. Authoritarianism, we don't have that yet, but COVID-19 showed a remarkable seizure of power by the state. Do you feel climate change demands for similar state action, firm state action?
It demands state action, not similar kind, but there is a risk of authoritarian instincts kicking in the case of climate change as well. When people are threatened, when they're afraid, they do look for some source of strength and hope, and that can easily be hijacked by authoritarian leaders, as we've seen around the world.
But now you say, of course, authoritarian rule, we don't want to get there. At the same time, there's some proof that authoritarian regimes find it much easier to impose the regulations and the measures that are necessary to stop climate change.
Easier? I mean, in the case of COVID, for example, the countries that are known for their authoritarianism, US, Brazil,
China.
India, Turkey, China is a different case. I think these new authoritarian countries, again, US, Brazil, Turkey, India, they have actually done worse. You would have expected these authoritarian leaders to shut down their borders.
But they didn't take COVID seriously.
So, they didn't. So the expectation that authoritarian leaders will necessarily deal with an urgent problem well has been proven to be misplaced in this case.
No, but that is about how you evaluate the problem. But in case you do want to intervene, mm-hmm. I was wondering if then a less democratic rule helps to get things through.
No, because this is not something that even a country the size of US or China can handle on its own. Just dealing with it at home undemocratically will buy some time, will create an illusion of safety. But the way to respond to this is globally, to mm-hmm. create a global force. So not a global government as such, but something at the level of globe that can have the legitimacy to inspire the type of changes that we need to make.
So you say the Green Deal by the European Commission, that is like the right level to put such a program in place?
It's the right level, but not the right solution, because it does not push us enough to stop the way that we're living. It doesn't. It is built on the hope that we can keep consuming and producing the same way, but reducing the environment, to delink the environmental impact of our actions. That type of delinking in the long term is wishful thinking.
Yeah. And do you feel that there is like support in societies, in countries, for such a radical change, as you say, changing the way we produce and consume?
There is more of it, but again, to the extent that it translates into political power, there has to be more sacrifice made in Europe, in North America, and some of the industrial rich countries that have created the problem of climate change.
Can I come in here? Because instead of saying it's sacrifice, it could be to look at, does consumption, does the sort of, we're saying, comfortable life, how much do we need, how many things do we need? Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is changing our own attitude to what's needed, right? Well-being and health. And to some extent, COVID, I think for many people, middle class, comfortable, people with a house, all of those things, those people realize, actually, we don't need so many things that we thought we did. We probably don't really need the holidays jetting around the world that you were referring to. We probably don't need that many clothes, that much type of food. I mean, there's a whole range of things people have been rethinking. I'm not saying that's going to lead necessarily to major change, but at least it's a shift. And to me, that is where this sort of pause, forced pause, Also, even, you know, all the interest in animals suddenly appearing in streets and everything, people started to think a bit more about value of environment. Maybe that's different from climate, but at least value of other beings, other more than human beings, right? I think that also is part of the discussion now. Or, I don't know if you agree, Murad, but that to me is interesting as well.
I mean, I agree that a lot of what passes as necessary is not. But I think once we strip away the superfluous, the amount of sort of degrowth that will come out of it will not be sufficient for the rest of the world to catch up to a point where they have sufficient material emancipation. I think we're talking, Europe has to cut back dramatically. It doesn't mean we have to destroy these buildings and never travel again. But the amount of degrowth we do here will not create sufficient space in India, in China, in anywhere else in the world for them to realize their very real and genuine and justified need for more consumption.
Mm. And Murad, to wrap this up, do you see somewhere like a green sprout of hope?
They're very, very, very tentative. I'm not much of a gardener, so I might not be able to spot them. But there is, going back to, again, the example of Extinction Rebellion, my nine-year-old son, the way he speaks about it, the way he's sort of like already politicized about it, I think that might be the way forward.
Okay, good. Because we've got to move on to our third topic, because simultaneously, Inge already said it, there's a third crisis worldwide, Black Lives Matter. So we're very happy that Aminata Kairos is here, and she spoke at a demonstration in Amsterdam recently, a demonstration against racism. And we've got a little clip of 1 minute speaking you there. Let's have a look at that.
We're here, and that means something. Because racism is so insidious. This thing has been going on for 400 years. And it's not just about what is out there, but what it has been doing to us. We have been ingesting this racism, and it is in our pores, and it is in our beings, and it is normalized. And so we don't question when somebody puts us down. We don't question when our stories are not heard. We don't question when we are marginalized, because it is normalized. And so the challenge is, we come with our rage. We come with our pain. The challenge is, we all need a detox. In America, we said we all drank the Kool-Aid, which is a horrible reference I'll tell you about some other time. But we all drank the Kool-Aid. Toni Morrison says racism is a distraction. Somebody else said, no, it's not a distraction, it's systematic. What I'm telling you, racism is tiresome. Racism drains your life energy. Racism drains your humanity from you. And so that is the fight. So that when we show up to do this fight, when we show up to do the structures, how can we do it with the fullness of our humanity?
Yeah. You say racism is 400 years old, even older. The Romans had slaves. Why has it now become a global thing?
Well, I think the COVID had a lot to do with that.
What was the relation between the two?
Because we were vulnerable and we were still. We were at home, we were sitting. And so, you know, we also live in a time of social media, so we being fed all this, so we were able to see it, but we also sitting and still and not running and going to work, but we were actually present and we were vulnerable. We were already feeling stuff and insecure. And so that confrontation, I think, really hit home.
So being vulnerable by COVID made us more sensitive to this kind of injustice that we saw on the social media.
Yeah, and also, and the fact that it was global, the response was global. And so to me, here's the story of this, you know, of this injustice to this Black man, but it also inspired people to think about injustice, period. You know, and about the unfairness, period. You know, so you saw indigenous people, you know, this is what's happening to indigenous men, this is what happened, you know, in Palestine, you know, everybody was emboldened by that. So you connected to the story of this Black man and the police brutality, but at the same time, that story was also a means for people to look around and say, you know what? Stuff like that is happening here too. Maybe not in that way, but that inequality and that injustice is happening. And that's, I think, what really touched people. And you know, got the energy going.
And was that new that, for example, here in the Netherlands, it also grew as a movement? Or was that something that had also been, you know, starting to boil a little bit and then all of a sudden came out in the open?
Well, you know, the Netherlands is unique in a way. So of course, talk about racism, you know, has been around for a very long time. But, you know, Dutch people don't like to talk about racism. They don't like to deal with racism. And so that's something that happens in America, or that's, you know, that's South Africa. But here, you know, we like to be colorblind. And in
are
particular,
we more reluctant to than in other countries people are reluctant to talk about racism?
So. Yeah? I think so.
How do you explain for that?
Well, I mean, what I've been told is because of World War II. You know, so we don't want to be, you know, so for instance, we don't register, you know, we don't like to talk about, you know, because we want to be colorblind because of, you know, World War II was so horrible and people were killed based on their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So therefore we don't do that mm-hmm. as if racism then doesn't exist.
But we declared it a taboo, but nevertheless, it was a daily practice.
Yes. Yeah. And so those who were trying to speak out about it, so you always get shut down. It's like, it's not that bad. You're sensitive. Or we're tolerant and we're nice. And racism is not about being nice, but it's about a system of inequality. And so, So it becomes very personal. And because people feel it personal, then they don't want to deal with it. As opposed to when you look at it, well, this is a system that exists. And this is a system that we are a part of. And that we cannot escape. That's different as opposed to you're a nice person or you're not a nice person. Mm-hmm. So that's what it becomes. And then we don't want to talk about it, or it becomes very contentious, or it's always very painful.
Wendy?
Oh, I'm listening. I think the complicity of whiteness in all of this as well. So it's not just about, it's Black Lives Matters, but it's also the ways in which whiteness has been complicit in it not mattering before, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's very difficult. Similarly to what we were saying, it's hard to let go of our privilege in terms of consumerism. I think it's also hard to let go of our privilege in terms of what we don't see, right? Mm-hmm. Which is mm-hmm. our whiteness. And I think that's something at ISS we're really trying to work with. It's complicated here. We have people from around the world. We have mostly white professors. So mm-hmm. I think these are the sorts of things are very, as you say, institutional. It's not just about the individuals.
Right.
So how to work in allyship with others is a bit what I think Murad was saying, sometimes to learn to just be quiet and listen to actually what is racism here, mm-hmm. including in this mm-hmm. building as well.
Yeah.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
I mean, the Black Lives Matter comes from the United States, but racism is universal.
Right.
Race discrimination is transhistorical.
Right.
Is there a risk, and you know the American scene and the Dutch scene mm-hmm. very well personally, is there a risk that by using the Black Lives Matter movement as a starting point, we might be importing some aspects of specific American forms of injustice mm-hmm. into European or Indian or Turkish discourses? I mean,
mm-hmm. what do you think about if you say typical American forms of racism?
I mean, race and racism, as much as they're universal, they don't manifest themselves the same way around the world. Mm-hmm. The way racism and slavery was brought to the U.S. is different than the way racism developed in the Middle East, for mm-hmm. example. So by using the same language, are we mm-hmm. in some ways inhibiting genuine change at the local level in different parts?
And I appreciate that because I personally sometimes feels like, I know you're looking at the U.S., but it is different. Right. But I think it can be an entry point, but you have to take the time then to figure out it's not exactly like the US. Well, then what is it? What does it look like here? Because what I've encountered, so in the Netherlands, it's even hard to talk about it. You know, in the US it's hard, but at least we can talk about it. But here, just the mention of it is like, you know, so then
by the whites or by just anybody.
By white people
yeah.
in particular. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very hard because, again, it's really quickly seen as taken as an affront. Mm-hmm. But I'm a nice person and it's not about that. Mm-hmm. So you have to...
It's a systemic thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, and we've been... And the Netherlands has really prided itself on, yeah, but we're colorblind and we're tolerant. So you have to even cut through that.
Yeah.
So yes, like I said, but it was, you know, it can be taken as an entry point. You know, you can be taken, and because it was so clear, you know, it's like there was no denying, like, oh my goodness, what, 8.5 minutes? okay, you know, I don't care where you are in the world, you can see that, like, no. But how does that translate? What forms does it take where I am, and how do I address it? So a lot of times even we take the theory and we take the language and then we try to implement it here. And I'm like, no, you know, even when you do critical race theory, that's based on a very particular history legally and how race was dealt with in the United States.
And I mean, we just presented it as being a third crisis, mm-hmm. Online with the COVID and the climate change. Yeah. But I was wondering, this seems to be a bit different as well. Of course, there's a crisis in how Black people are treated, for example, by American policemen. But isn't it also coming out a very strong emancipation movement and being a very positive thing?
Yeah. Oh, I'm not saying it's not positive.
No, I mean, it's just, you know, like correcting the way we presented it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's painful, but... You know, people are speaking out and shifting. And I know in the U.S., because I've met some of these Black Lives leaders, which a lot of them are mothers whose children have been, you know, killed by the police. So a lot of it is grassroots, and they're protesting at the courthouses, and they're getting laws changed. And, that, you know, it's at that level that stuff is taking place. So there's very much an emancipatory, and because it's not a top-down movement, it's bottom-up, and we don't have particular leaders. And so in that sense, I agree with you. It's very emancipatory in that way.
What I can react, you mentioned Black Lives Matter, a crisis. That's not how I phrase this. I think the racism. Is a crisis.
Yes,
of course.
The movement is a different thing. But I'm still wondering about, in Netherlands, the reaction of people, but... I'm not a racist. I did read a book of Hallo Witte Mensen, mm-hmm. and it has made such an impression on me, because you see how difficult people find to accept that. Is it about the reaction, I'm not a racist, or is it about, and I know how you do your workshops, what I'm saying is racism. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I have to be aware about what I'm saying, what I'm doing, my prejudices, my mm-hmm. biases. So I'm just wondering, how could you... deal with that, you know, that's automatic reaction about, I'm not.
But that's still an individual thing as opposed And so part of the system is that you are conditioned to be part of it and not see it. So what I try to do, also because I'm an anthropologist, is help people understand this is how the culture works. You were not meant to see. That's how it can exist. Yeah. That's how it can continue. As long as you don't know, because the moment you know, it's like, ugh, you know? So all of a sudden, people are being confronted. You know, all of a sudden they have to see, and that's what's so painful. You know, and they have to hear, and that's what's so painful. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a dynamic, because also people, you know, the ones who were marginalized, a lot of them were silent, like, people don't hear me anyway. Mm-hmm. And so now it's also like the explosion is there, you know. So it has also given us permission, you know what, all this time. So it also comes out like that. So that explosion is then even harder.
That's a bit comparable maybe to the Me Too movement, huh? That people who'd been silent because it had been such a humiliating experience. Yeah. I can imagine that experiencing racism is also a humiliating thing. But all of a sudden, if everybody stands up and speaks out, it gets voice.
Yeah, and I like that. And that was because in the Me Too movement, you know, women, we knew... You know, none of us were surprised.
Any woman.
It was like, somebody's finally listening. But we all knew, you know, so.
Absolutely. But I think then the issue is, how do you actually deal with it, right? In the same way, like, it's not enough to just speak out and have a voice. It's actually changing the institutions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, of course, the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. And again, as we're here at ISS, I think that's something that, people have been trying to deal with sexual harassment, inappropriate behavior, all sorts of things, very difficult to do in an institution. And similarly with racism, which has always been there too, but that's now emerging now in a very strong way. And even for us teachers, right, we're talking about development. Racism has informed development all the way through and having in the same way that gender bias has. So I think these are things that are institutional, literally here, that we're trying to deal with. The problem is that if it's in authoritarian regimes, it's going to also be hugely risky and dangerous. So I think a lot of it is how can you trust? How can you build trust as community groups? And on what issue that you're really trying to work with? So I think in terms of people working underground and trying to get those issues through. It's exactly what Murad said before. They need to be in solidarity with others. So I think that that's the main, my main thing is to not, the risk level is, when it's so high, solidarity with others is important.
And I think it's important to not silo these changes. We shouldn't be just Black Lives Matter activists or environmentalists or Me Too activists. I think we need to find the connections and make this a broad front and push for change that way. I think the work of care will have to be these different movements will have to care for each other and act in unison rather than in their specific interests. Doesn't mean these interests are not valid on their own, but they will not get very far unless they're pursued alone.
Yeah, and so could we say that the one thing that connects all the issues we've been discussing is the question of inequality? That's where you started with. And via climate change, we came with Aminata speaking about racism as a matter of inequality. Well, that's a thing, of course, to work on after this, because now we've got to wrap this up, and I would love to hand back the floor to Inge Hutter.
Thank you, Marcia. It is 1 hour. It's very short, especially these topics. So I hope you at home that you enjoyed the debate. I did, but very short. So for sure we're going to continue and follow up. The last suggestion by Murad, let's see also how they link to each other, because that's also what the idea was of this afternoon. So I think I don't summarize, because I think that's too short to do, and just to, I didn't make notes, but we'll definitely will follow up. If at home you have questions or you have ideas how we can continue or what we can do from ISS itself, in ISS itself and in the university, here or outside in the world, let us know. So that's events@iss.nl.